So welcome back. Tonight's topic is a fortunate rebirth. And I'm going to be speaking of it from two aspects, actually much more from one aspect than the other aspect. More from the karmic aspect in this lifetime rather than the mechanics of rebirth. That I will be going into when I speak next, which I think is in 3 or 4 weeks, something like that, and I'll have an assignment for you to read as well, just as Rich gave you one tonight. So I'm going to talk till about 8:30, and then I'm going to hand it over to Raphael to talk about his life, his transformation. One of the reasons I go into prison is because I'm always inspired by people who have made such differences in their own lives by being willing to sit in meditation, practice daily living mindfully, and see the harm they have caused themselves and others, and do something about it, change their lives. And that's why I asked Raphael to speak tonight on that topic in his own life. So there's three aspects of rebirth. One is karma, as I mentioned, in Pali, kama, K-A-M-M-A. The second is its results. It's called vipaka in Pali. And then finally, it's fruit, which is phala in Pali. And it just means that all your actions have consequences. It's not a big mysterious thing. It's actually a law, just like gravity is a law. It happens. So the two types of rebirth we're talking about, in our Western culture, our Buddhist Western culture, a lot of people are very uncomfortable talking about rebirth in the multiple birth sense. And this is where a lot of people just draw the line. Not going there. I don't believe that. I don't understand it. And actually, that's fine. You don't have to. You don't have to believe it or understand it. The Buddha did. And he taught it. But it has been redefined in Western Buddhism to, it can just include our lifetime or moment by moment. We are constantly dying and being reborn. And so that's fine too. However it works for you and you're comfortable with it, that's what you sit with. But I am going to ask you a couple times probably, keep an open mind about the other kind of rebirth. The Buddha taught it. If you've been practicing in this tradition, you might have found a lot of things seem to have come true that he had said. They work for you, and perhaps this is one of them. So just keep an open mind on it. The Dalai Lama was once asked, which is more important, the teachings on emptiness or karma? And he said the teachings on karma are much more important. Why do you think that is? We put so much emphasis on no permanent abiding self, on knowing emptiness, and yet the Dalai Lama said the teachings on karma are more important. I think it's because perhaps if we have experienced those times of no permanent abiding self, those moments of emptiness, and I was just reading this from one teacher, he said, eventually you get off the cushion and you're back in daily life again. And as one teacher said, hell is other people. And there you are. And this is where karma comes in. Now how are you going to act in this situation before you get on your next retreat and get your next aha moment? So karma is a misunderstood concept most of the time. Guy Armstrong calls it the science of happiness. And the Buddha devised steps, the Noble Eightfold Path, where are the steps to creating skillful karma for yourself and for others. Karma cannot be seen... completely by anyone, according to the Buddha, but a Buddha. It is so complex and so convoluted and so intertwined with so many things that it would be impossible. I think you've all heard here, the Buddha said, if you tried to figure this out, it's one of the four imponderables, it could drive you insane. You can't do it. Only a Buddha, somebody who is completely awake, can see the results of karma and what's been happening in other people's lives as well as our own. And as I mentioned, as far as rebirth to another lifetime, no one can tell you what to believe. The Buddha didn't have any doubt about it. I read this particular statement from Ajahn Pounedamo, and he says, the Buddha taught that we are neither immortal souls nor human machines. There is no self either to endure or to be destroyed. Consciousness is itself void and conditionally arisen. It is neither created nor destroyed. Rather, it arises dependent upon certain causal factors, which include an object, a physical base, karma, and previous moments of consciousness. For consciousness to arise in the womb must imply a previous existence to activate this causal link. Otherwise, we would have an arbitrary or random arising, which would violate dependent origination. That's something to think about. That's kind of a heavy-duty statement. In the Buddha's time, there were all kinds of views on karma. Karma was an accepted fact of life, but what wasn't accepted by everybody was the results of karma. So some people said everything was predestined. Other people said there was free will. Other people said that it didn't matter what you did. Certain actions would cause certain results and others wouldn't. And the arguments went on endlessly. And the Buddha said these are all speculative views. So what does he mean by speculative view? He means that these are all just arguments that people have not experienced and can't prove. And he said he could, that he saw it. He saw how karma worked, and he said, karma is action with volition or intention. That's what it is. It's cause and effect. So actions are wholesome or unwholesome. In Pali, you call it kusala, which is wholesome, or akusala, which is unwholesome. And everything is conditioned in the mind. Everything that you do starts where? With a thought. Everything starts with a thought. And this is where we have some control over our karma. The past is gone, the future is yet to be, but in this present moment, we can decide how we are going to respond. Not react, but respond. This is from the Dhammapada. Mind precedes all mental states. Mind is their chief. They are all mind wrought. If with an impure mind a person speaks or acts, suffering follows him like the wheel that follows the foot of the ox. Mind precedes all mental states. Mind is their chief. They are all mind wrought. If with a pure mind a person speaks or acts, happiness follows him like a never departing shadow. So the Buddha emphasized karma is not a religion. It's not a religion. It doesn't matter if you believe in God or not. It isn't dependent on a deity. It just is. It's a law, like the law of gravity. So the important thing to remember here is karma results from intention. Volitional intention, meaning I mean to do that. I want this to happen, and I'm going to make it happen. Or a thought which is just careless, and you're putting absolutely no intention behind it. So I was thinking of some examples of when something unskillful happens due to advice you might have given somebody, and they took it and things didn't turn out well, that was not good advice that you gave them? Is that unskillful karma for you? What do you think? Who thinks it's unskillful karma by giving bad advice? What was your intention? Exactly. That's exactly it. What was your intention by giving this advice? Maybe it was the best advice you could give according to your own experiences in life, but it didn't work for this person. But you had the best of intentions. That happens. So you've not accumulated unwholesome karma due to that. Your intention was pure. Your intention was skillful. So it's also called in the section I asked you to read, a very short section, the first sutta in the book on rebirth, on the section on rebirth. He also talks about dark karma and bright karma. That's also the same as akusala and kusala. And then there's a mixed karma, which I think is very interesting because I think that's where most of us are most of the time. And the example I've seen, and I'm sure you've all experienced this too, I certainly have, doing something kind for someone, you know, really, this is very skillful and kind, but not getting the thank you that you wanted. And then all of a sudden it's, well, what happened? I had this great intention and they're not appreciating me. Well, that's mixed karma. That's getting mixed results. You started out with good intentions, but they've kind of fell apart midway through. So the Buddha gave a list. This is the second reading under A Fortunate Rebirth that I encourage you to read. It's page 156 through 161, Majjhima Nikaya 41, and it's on the 10 unwholesome actions. And it's a useful list to see how well you are taking control of your own life. I love this list. I refer to it a lot. And it's also an easy list to remember. It's three conditions of body, four of speech, and three mental conditions. And the first four are the first four of the five precepts. So not harming living beings, not taking what is not freely given, not engaging in sexual misconduct, and not lying, which is the first of unskillful speech. And then abstaining from harsh speech, abstaining from slander, and abstaining from idle chatter or gossip. And then the final three are covetousness, you know, wanting what somebody else has, comparing yourself to how you're doing compared to what they're doing, ill will, and then finally wrong view. And wrong view is very simply not thinking there's karma, not thinking your actions have any consequences. The wholesome actions are all exactly the opposite. And the Buddha talked about the bliss of blamelessness, and this comes with the acting with good intention. It leads to happiness, which leads to concentration, which leads to insight, which leads to freedom, the bliss of blamelessness. So Oprah Winfrey interviewed the Dalai Lama a number of years ago, and she asked him about his life. You know, said, is there anything that you're, you know, kind of regretting, you know, blame yourself for, feel guilty about? And he thought for a while, and then he said, yes, my attitude towards mosquitoes and bedbugs is not favorable. And she said, that's it? That's what you regret? And he said, yes, I've made small mistakes every day, but no major mistakes. And she said, you have no regrets. That's a great life. That's an incredible life. And he replied, I don't lag too far behind those who have spent many, many years in solitude. You know, what a wonderful thing to be able to say as you're nearing the end of your life, it's been a good life. I don't have hardly any regrets, except not especially liking mosquitoes and bedbugs. So equanimity, the fourth of the Brahma Viharas, boundless friendliness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and then equanimity, upeka, is also all tied up with karma and the teaching of karma, because equanimity teaches us that we create our own destinies. And this is one of the sayings that goes along with equanimity. All beings are heirs to their karma. Their happiness and unhappiness are the result of their past actions and more than my wishes for them. And sometimes this can seem like a shock. It can seem really tough. And especially in this Western culture where our Declaration of Independence says all people are created equal. Well, tell me, like, karma is not saying that. And actually, it's not. You've noticed that some people who shouldn't be, well, the example that I've thought of is Pol Pot. Pol Pot in Cambodia, I believe he murdered close to 3 million people. I think that's the right figure. And nothing really happened to him. He left Cambodia, went into exile, and then died, I think, 10 years after he went into exile. According to the law of karma, if you believe in rebirth, it didn't happen in this lifetime, but it will happen in another. And so even being equanimous with someone like Pol Pot, if you believe in rebirths, if you don't, that's a tough one to take. That's a really difficult one to take. Does this mean that we shouldn't care? I mean, you know, that's a result of their karma. I know years ago, and I gave a talk on this, maybe Rich might remember, many years ago, after the tsunami in Southeast Asia. Remember, I mean, so many people were killed. And Sharon Stone, that wonderful Buddhist teacher, said, well, it's their karma. Rich thinking, you know, millions of people, it's their karma to die like that? No. No, it's not. It doesn't mean that we don't have compassion, but it does mean that we might not be able to do anything about it. How many of you have family or friends who you see going off the deep end and you sit and talk to them because you don't want this to happen to them? How many of you have that? Sure. We all do. And sometimes you can change their minds and steer them in a right direction, and sometimes you can't. That's their karma. You've done the best you can. You showed compassion. But it's nothing. There's nothing you can do to change other than your response. Their reactivity is their reactivity. So the results of skillful karma come in many different ways. So before, and you've heard this before, during, and after. Before a skillful act or a kind act, you feel good about it. You know you're going to do something that's kind, that's going to benefit others. Makes you feel good. During, you also feel, yeah, this is right. This feels right. Except the example I gave, you're expecting, you know, everybody to say, God, you're great, you're so good, look at all the stuff you're giving. Forget that. And then after the action, you should feel good about what took place. Then we recognize, when we engage in skillful karma, we recognize our habitual states of mind, and we can start correcting them, or we can start enhancing them. One of my favorite suttas is Majjhima Nikaya, 19, and it's called The Two Types of Thinking. And I read this periodically because it's when the Buddha became enlightened, he actually took his thoughts and put them into two categories, the skillful ones and the unskillful ones. He noticed whatever causes happiness to myself and others doesn't cause harm is skillful. What causes unhappiness and harm to myself and others is unskillful and to be avoided. And that's what this this fourth aspect is. We start recognizing and we start practicing what is skillful and helpful and causes happiness and what isn't. The fifth one, okay, this one you don't have to accept. This goes back to rebirth again in multiple lifetimes. We can expect results to happen in the future. Actually, that's the sixth one. So if you believe the first five, that's good. You don't want to accept the sixth one, that's fine. You don't have to. Here to mix it up even a little bit more, not everything is attributed to karma. Not everything is. The Buddha actually said there's five types of karma, and only one of them do we have control over. We don't have control over the seasons. We don't have control over our genetics. We don't have control over illnesses we get. We don't have control over when it's going to be windy or there's going to be an earthquake. We don't have control over these things. We have control of how we respond to them. That's it. And we have control of how we think in this moment, which is shaping our response to what is taking place. And by the way, these are all called niyamas, and I'm not going to go into all of them because I've only got a couple more minutes. The good news about karma is good karma persisted in can thwart the reaping of bad karma. Do you all know the story of Angulimala? He was the murderer who was given very bad advice by his teacher, who told him to go out and kill 1,000 people. It's a long story, and I'm not going to go into it right here, but he went out and did that. And when he got to 999, he wore the fingers of his victims around his neck. Angulimala means 1,000 fingers, 1,000-finger necklace. And by the time he got to 999, he met the Buddha. And he was going to kill the Buddha. And through these Buddha's superpowers or whatever, he couldn't do it. The Buddha told him to stop, and he stopped. And not only did he stop, the Buddha told him he needed to become a monk. And he did immediately. And the Buddha, because he was able to see karma in past lives, said all the merit he had earned in previous lives way outdid all the bad karma that he was gaining in this lifetime with the killings that he did. So he forgave him. Actually pardoned him. Didn't forgive. That's another talk. That was my last talk. I said he pardoned him, didn't forgive him, per my last talk. And so Angulimala became, actually in Southeast Asia, he's known kind of as the patron saint of pregnant women. He went out and was very compassionate to women who were giving birth. People still threw stones and things at him and hated him, but they wouldn't kill him because he was one of the Buddha's monks. He came back to the Buddha and said, "They hate me. They're throwing stones at me. What am I going to do?" And the Buddha said, "Bear it." That's it. That was what he had to work out due to his actions, even though his good merit outweighed the bad karma. So, final thing I'm going to say about this, and then I'm going to let Raphael take the microphone. You can't look in a rear view mirror and say, well, that was the result of karma. That's why that happened. For yourself or anybody else. The Buddha said, this is a tangle of views. You're not capable of doing this. but you're capable of compassion and being present to what's taking place and using the wisdom you develop in your mindfulness and meditation practice. That's what you're capable of. So, as I mentioned, one last thing. Auspicious time of karma is when you are near death. Thich Nhat Hanh said, and he obviously believes in rebirth, the last thought of this lifetime is the first thought in the next. And this is also why when people are in the dying process, you know, I'm a trained chaplain, and I know we've got some more trained chaplains here. The first thing that you are told to do is when you are with these people, to remind them of the good they have done in their life. Constantly remind them of that. This is an auspicious time to override the negativity that they might be feeling and remembering the good that they did. This is, again, taking, if there is a rebirth, taking the last thought of this life into the first thought of the next. So I'm going to end it there, and I'm going to turn it over to Raphael, and he's going to talk for about 25 minutes, and then 5 minutes to nine, he'll stop, and you have questions for either he or I. You can ask them.
I should talk about love and gratitude because that's what I'm feeling right now. And before I talk about love and gratitude, I'd like to share a little bit about my experience. And then I'm going to share some of the practice that we do here. How this practice not only allowed me to experience a rebirth, but it actually took me to a new birth, a new life. One that I never imagined that I would be able to feel and see and touch and appreciate. I always imagined that the way my life began, that's the way it would end. And the way my life began, and God bless my mother in blessed memory, and my father who's still here on this side with me. Haven't seen him in a long time. But my life began with a lot of pain and suffering. Poppy Pops was an alcoholic. Was. And my mother, well, she's to blame because she married him. But really, she, in loving empathy for the life that she was brought up with, She had to look out for herself. She had to learn how to love herself. And although she brought five of us into this world with her husband, my father, she still had to look out for herself. And her idea of doing that was to get away and leave us with him. And she did it throughout. But she always came back. So I love her for that. But I hated her and I hated him for how I was feeling. And I didn't want to feel it. So I became very angry with myself and with them. I became very disconnected with myself. And I tried to get away from myself. Didn't quite do it, but I did suffer. It was very painful. And one of the ways that I was trying to escape from what I was feeling inside was to be revengeful, to allow that anger to come out in rage. And that meant that I was a very offending individual in Los Angeles. I was very criminal and very addicted to drugs. And no one deserved to feel what I was feeling. No one. Because I'm hurting and I'm running away from this pain, why should anyone else have to experience pain and suffering? So there's a lot of regret for that. There's a lot of pain from that. And I can't make it go away. I've learned how to accept this with this practice. Does karma ever go away? Not for me. I accept that. When I was sent to prison in 1983, I thought that that would be a way that I would not have to feel inside what I was feeling, because so much about prison is what's happening outside of me. So that was a perfect place for me to be, not to have to feel. And the last revenge that I was able to exact with my mother was to make that phone call to let her know where I was and where I was going. She didn't know that I would be gone for the rest of her life. She waited 33 years, 32 years, and she passed away from Alzheimer's. And I always thought that it was because of her presence in my life after she passed away physically, that her soul and her spirit and her love allowed me to have presence before the Board of Parole Hearings. And that's why I'm here sitting with you all today. The governor opposed it. So there was a lot of opposition. Certainly the victims. None of them were murdered, but they were traumatized beyond belief. And they have to live with that. And I have to live with it also. So prison, and all of its violence, and the hardship of being locked in a small cell, I didn't have to feel what I was feeling inside. And it was a perfect escape from what I didn't want to feel about myself. Whenever something violent happened to me in prison, and it did many times, I think the worst was when my cellmate sexually assaulted me. I thought that I deserved it. Whenever something bad happened to me, I deserved it. I hope that I would not have become addicted to karma and to the violence that was a part of prison life. But in some ways, maybe I was attached to it. And then, where does the rebirth, the transformation, the change, the evolution, where does that come into play in my life? In 2002, some volunteers came into San Quentin, Soledad. And they passed the word out, who wants to come in and sit and meditate for a little while? And I don't know why I went. There was no formal practice. I didn't read any books on meditation. But I did go in and we sat and we meditated. And there was a shift in my life. I became aware of my body, of where I was mentally, I became aware of where I was physically. And I didn't know what was happening with me from this practice of sitting in stillness and silence and meditating. I had no idea what was taking place with me inside of me. But I did know that detachment, that loneliness, that pain that I was trying to run away from, it seemed to become weaker. And my ability to feel started returning to me. And I was able to cry for the first time in my life. Actual tears. Tears for what I had done. Tears for all of the years of running away from myself, destroying my life. I remember one of the prison administrators telling me at a classification committee when I got to San Quentin, and he looked at my record, and my record went back to 1974, and he said, "Young man, do you know how long you're going to be in here?" And I looked at him without a care in the world, and he said, "You're going to be in here for a long time." And I was in there for a long time. But when I returned to San Quentin, this was in the 80s when that gentleman made that statement to me. And when I returned in 2004, 2005, something very special greeted me at San Quentin. And it wasn't the gun towers, it wasn't the level of violence, but it was a sangha. It was a thriving community of convicts and volunteers sitting together, and it was so real. Here I am inside of the most violent prison, and there is a community of compassionate, loving, peaceful, peace-loving people, inmates and volunteers. And so I started practicing formally with them. And it's a Zen tradition, so we read a lot about Thich Nhat Hanh. We read a lot about and spoke a lot about, in the Dharma talks, about the practice of awareness, the practice of silence, stillness, learned about compassion and empathy, and all of these things began to come alive in my life. I began to feel hopeful. I began to learn how to love myself, how to forgive myself, because that was the most difficult. I want to say how much I love and appreciate Green Gulch and the volunteers that continue to come in there every Sunday evening, doing the same kind of work that Buddhism Pathways Prison Project is doing with other prisons, with Diane and the volunteers. Through that love, I began to feel alive. And that small cell that I was living in, so small I could touch the walls, and I'm not a big person. I could touch both walls when I went in. That small cell became so big, so huge. And I didn't feel like I was locked in a prison cell anymore. It's almost as if the whole universe opened up to me. I still had the fear and the shame. It didn't go away. It's here right now. But I've learned how to accept it and to be mindful of it, to be aware of it. Thankfully, the love that I feel here, I don't have to cry about it right now. I can share about it. But I don't mind the tears. I don't mind the shame. Because there's an opportunity for me to feel like a human being again. Not like a number, C-138-95 or D-11492. I don't have to think of myself as a monster, as an evil person, someone who was accursed. I don't have to feel that way. Empathy and compassion has given me a new life. It may be called a new birth, a rebirth, but I think that it has given me back what I always had here in my heart. Maybe the karma has not ended. There are some dues to pay, some amends to be made in my life. And I'm willing to submit myself . I thought that maybe my life would never amount to anything as a human being. A sense of worthlessness is something that I was attached to. But this practice has opened my heart and my mind, and it has given me something that is so special, so unique to this practice, that now I can open my eyes and my heart, and I could look into yours, and I could feel you. I could see you. I could touch you. I can receive your hugs and your kind words, and not be closed-minded about it. And some say that it's a transformation, that it's a change, but I say that it's an awakening. This practice, stillness, and silence becomes me. And becoming me, I become you. And you become me. That is so special in my life today. I don't know what the future holds, because I'm loving this moment even more. I want to thank you for allowing me to share this little story about my life. And I want to encourage you to join in with Diane and the Buddhism Pathways Prison Project, because there's a lot of souls that are being brought back to life inside of these California prisons. And hopefully, many more men will be able to feel the experience of coming back to life and being able to enjoy it and appreciate it for what it really is. So thank you, and I love you.
We have about 5 minutes. I asked Raphael if he'd be willing to take any questions from anybody, or if you have any questions of me on anything at all. He's an extremely open person. I think you can just ask him just about anything you want. And, you know, about his life, his transformation, whatever. Any comments or questions?
Yeah. I just want to thank you for your for what you said about being able to feel spacious in the space. Thank you. Taking your journey through the program, did you experience any fears? Was coming into you, did that frighten you in any way?
Thank you for that question. Probably going to be the best question I have to answer tonight. I still feel that fear. I still feel the pain and the suffering connected with that pain. I fear that my life will be worthless. I fear that I would not be accepted by society, by the communities. I fear that I will not be loved. And in this practice, I realize that from all the running, all the criminal activity, the drug addiction, all I ever really wanted was to be loved. That's it. So it's my greatest fear. Thank you.
I have one last thing to say, and it's 1:01, and I hope Raphael doesn't mind this. My half of the Donna I want to give to Raphael. He needs a lot of dental work done, and he has no money to have it done. And it'll be a small gesture to hopefully help getting him to a dentist, since he's not covered by any insurance or anything like that. So. Please consider that when you're leaving Donna tonight. My hand will go towards hopefully some dental procedures.
Mm-hmm.
All right. If there is Okay, one more thing. Yes.
I just wanted to say that your experience is the same as all of our experiences. So you're I think everyone in this room has experienced this. We're all in this together.
Can all of you feel the anxiety, panic attacks that I feel? Well, I'm not saying that misery loves company, but I hope that together that we'll be aware of it. For me, awareness means everything, means the world. Because I never wanted to feel myself. I was always trying to escape and run away from myself. And in so doing, I destroyed my life and many other innocent lives. I didn't murder anyone. But who's to say that the trauma that I caused in their lives is not as bad as if I murdered them? And so we have something very special here, and that is, for me, the awareness that you love me and that I love you, and that no matter what is going on in my life, that I can always look to that compassion to bring me back and to give me healing. So I'm still trying to heal. I hope that you'll help me along the way. Thank you.
Thank you. The merit that we generated tonight through our discussion and through Raphael's honest sharing, may it be given freely to all living beings. May suffering be eliminated in all of our lives and the lives of all living beings in this lifetime. Thank you all for coming.